time now for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode 76, wherein we talk with a counselor, a licensed counselor, in the second and third blocks about abuse, about spousal abuse, and all the different types of abuse that there are. So it's a very good episode.
Very good. Not.
But not really.
Not really happy.
No, not happy. Beneficial.
It's good. It's really good.
There's a tremendous amount of spiritual moments, insightful moments. Is it cheery? No, it's not cheery. And speaking of not cheery things, I've got two new reviews on our iTunes. You can subscribe to The Cultural Hall on iTunes and leave a message there, and I would like to share those with you. I'll share the better one first.
Okay. Oh, I thought they were both bad.
No. One of them, 5 stars. That's the best you can get. This one from Smile Inca, which I'm thinking means smile in California, says, "I love The Cultural Hall podcast!" Exclamation point. And that's it. Simple. 5-star. Thanks for the review.
Well, of course you're happy. You live in California.
How could you not?
Yeah.
Here's the other one.
Oh, good.
3 stars.
It's not terrible.
With the subject, not so sure yet, and goes on to write, "I haven't completely decided if I'm going to continue to listen to this podcast or not. The premise is very fun." Thank you. "I really like the idea of discussing Mormon culture and society. But of the several shows I've listened to so far, this seems to be a means of justifying not living the gospel completely, mingled with sarcasm. Justification seems to be made, which discourages full commitment to gospel standards or morality and covenants made. I give more credence to the words of our leaders, scriptures, and publications, which give proper guidance, such as for the Strength of Youth pamphlet, than I do to the guest speakers who have a more complex or altered view of living the gospel. I'll listen to a few more, but I feel it's causing me to feel uncomfortable in viewing God's unchanging standards. Then I'm going to abandon this podcast and look for some more wholesome listening entertainment."
Well, I'm glad you're going to listen for 2 more.
Yeah, a few more.
Thanks. A few. Maybe 3.
So here's the deal. I at no time have professed, I don't think, that this is a great standard of, hey, you know what, you know, the gospel according to The Cultural Hall. That's not what we're here for.
This ain't scripture, buddy.
Yeah. Pal. Bucko. But to me, it definitely is a place where we can talk about how people aren't perfect and how people have struggles.
We do. We are a little bit cynical here, I guess, in a way, mm-hmm. but by no means are we putting down any of our beliefs or the statutes on which the gospel is founded in any way. But we do joke a bit about it. And I think most people get that.
Yeah.
Because we have to laugh at ourselves because we're a different people.
And sometimes I think that the way that we deal with difficult things that we struggle with, is by making a joke about it. And
yes,
maybe that isn't the best way to go about it. Maybe it's a time to take a somber moment and go, oh, you know what? That's really something I need to work on.
Yeah.
But in this case, we choose to laugh about it. And I don't think that anyone would say that the prophet isn't the prophet, that the scriptures aren't true, that the gospel isn't the gospel. But we, you know, everyone has struggles. To say that you don't, you are a liar.
Yeah, we're not trying to change any of the opinions of the church or say that we have a different opinion. We're doing it a little bit lightly.
Yeah.
You know, I think everybody that participates in this podcast has the same belief and is pretty active in this mm-hmm. church. And here we do show that lightheartedness. And you know, maybe in some people's elders' quorum, or I doubt in Relief Society, but in elders' quorum, sometimes it goes that way a little bit, mm-hmm. depending on the people there.
Mm-hmm. Not Relief Society, though, no.
No, they have doilies.
Way. Yeah.
Nothing is funny when you got doilies.
Not a chance. But so to you, Family Focus, which is the name of that person, we hope that you will continue to listen to the podcast and, you know, give us a chance and give us some one-on-one feedback. I'd love to know what in particular you're talking about. Anyway, so coming up in the second and third block of the Cultural Hall, it is a licensed counselor. He's talking about spousal abuse. You'd be surprised. I learned a lot in this. Check it out. Second and third block of the Cultural Hall.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's time for the second block of the Cultural Hall, and here with us we've got Kirk Voss, who is an LMFT, which we'll talk about in a second because I want to know what that is. But we're talking all about spousal abuse, both physical, emotional, and we'll probably get into some other things as well, signs of these things and maybe family members and some of that kind of stuff. But certainly this isn't your nyuk-nyuk chuckle episode of the Cultural Hall. Definitely serious things, but we do want to be able to talk about it and be able to help out those that are listening that may need this help, or if you know someone, to provide that as a resource. So Kirk Voss is an LMFT, which I'm guessing means Licensed Marriage and Family Therapist.
That's impressive. That's right.
It's because it's right here on your bio, right in front of you.
Well, that was easy.
It says that he works with individuals, couples, and families to address a variety of emotional and mental health issues. Kirk received his master's degree in family studies, marriage, and family therapy from the University of Maryland. Is that a pretty good school for that?
Yeah, top tier. It's great.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Well, so don't mess around here. He received his bachelor's degree in human development and family studies from the University of Utah. Kirk is a member of the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, and he is fluent in English and Portuguese.
That's right.
I'm guessing from a mission in Brazil.
You would be guessing correctly.
And because you told me that before I turned on the microphone, I knew that. He's worked as a therapist both inpatient treatment and outpatient community therapy clinics in both Maryland and Utah. He also worked for several years at LDS Family Services, and he is now a referred provider for that agency. So let's get into it with this email. I do that just so people understand, too, that it's not just Kirk who we actually went to high school together, but it's not Kirk who just happens to have some opinions about, you know, marriage and spousal abuse and those kind of things. But he knows what he's talking about.
Sure.
And he said top two. So I'm guessing Maryland is two then, right?
Well, let's not talk about it. Yeah. That's not important.
What's the number one school for
that stuff? Well, you know, last I heard there was, at least when I was going to school, there was like three schools that were kind of all vying for that top position. And I never heard the official ranking. I just knew that it was in the top three. So
all right. So here's how this email goes. It says, and this is anonymous. Says, I'm a convert to your podcast as well as a facilitator in my local ARP pornography. What's ARP? ARP pornography sexual addiction program?
Addiction recovery program.
Oh, okay.
Probably. Yeah.
So the LDS church thing, probably?
It could be. I know that they term it different things. So.
Okay. The ARP pornography sexual addiction program, as well as one who has been through a whole lot of other support and therapy groups, both voluntarily and court ordered. Goes on, I was excommunicated in 2004 and have worked hard to where I am now, which is quite close to coming back into this fold. So way to go, this person. By the way, Kirk, this is Lindsay.
Hi.
Lindsay,
okay,
Kirk.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
That being said, here we go. That being said, there's one aspect of spousal abuse that I believe is not talked about enough, which I was guilty of, says this person. I still view as abuse, and that is sexual addiction. From the incessant demand and manipulation to, quote, put out, to infidelity, as well as the emotional and the huge risk of STDs is a real problem, not only in society, but within the church membership. And quite frankly, I believe it to be a taboo subject in the church because of the idea that, quote, what happens in the bedroom is none of my business. Attitude. There is in the mind of the abused and added supposed knowledge that one does not measure up to all those pornographic images, mistresses or prostitutes, excitement or erotic appeal that is seen as more desirable in the eye of the abuser. Additionally, this addiction gives birth to the same codependent partner who has a difficult time separating themselves from the perpetrator, just as the one who's being physically beaten. Goes on. Our church has become so good at dealing with the sinner that quite often the victims are left to their own devices. I believe it's time for the church to not shy away from establishing a coordinated effort between units to help the victims, of which I use broadly to include the whole family as well as the sinner. I say between units because in almost every case that I know of, one or the other is moved to a different unit where quite often there are no established friends or support and the person goes on suffering alone. Then this person goes on to say, I guess this was less of a question and more just a subject or two that I wanted to bring up. So let's start there. We talk about the first thing, which is abuse is kind of a sexual addiction and the incessant demand and manipulation to put out. Let's dive right in.
Well, the light stuff, that's nice.
Yeah. I didn't want to, our time is limited, Kirk. Let's get to it.
That's right. Well, I do believe that this is a topic that goes largely undiscussed. I'd agree with that. Not because it's not impossible to go into, and it's not going to be a problem for people to know more about. I think where people get stuck is there's a lack of familiarity with the topic, and so a lot of church leaders, for example, might end up, you know, on a local level, might end up just kind of brushing past it, ignoring it, kind of dealing with other things, and meaning well, but not necessarily having the experience level. Hence the need for outpatient counseling outside of just a conversation with a bishop when you're dealing with something that you're healing from. Quite often, that's a process that's necessary. It doesn't happen. With regard to the abuse that can happen, I do consider unaddressed sexual addictions and pornography addictions to be a form of abuse. However, I take maybe a different slant on it than maybe others would. The research that I've read and that I ascribe most to would indicate that people get into pornography for 100 different reasons. It's exposed to them. They get shown it when they're a kid. You know, see it on billboards, for heaven's sake. It's everywhere now. Mm-hmm. But the reason that they return to pornography is 95% emotion-based, not physical. Now, sure, there's a physical component, and there's an emotional, or rather, there's a sexual drive that's involved. I'm not going to, you know, pretend that that's absent. However, people don't return on a compulsive level strictly for physical reasons 95% of the time.
So what kind of things would draw them to go back to it? I mean, obviously, you're saying emotional, but like what? Like
they're filling an emotional gap, right? So people have core basic emotional needs that they're trying to fill on a subconscious level. They don't realize they're doing it. And if they don't have those needs, they're going to look for them, and they're going to go hunting for them hardcore.
Like they're not being satisfied type deal?
I think, you know, satisfied is already a sexually charged word.
I didn't mean it that way. I just, you know, I'm unfulfilled, like, sure, emotionally and physically. Like, if you're... Yeah, they're going to go seek it somewhere else.
Sure. I mean, on a core level, everyone on a universal basis, men, women, and children, we're all on some level, we're trying to feel emotional safety, a sense of security in our role and the roles of the people that matter most to us, and then a sense of being loved and appreciated. And we're going to feel that best from our partner when our partner is accessible, you know, reachable and engaged in the process. When we don't have that connection with people, when we don't have that core connection that really matters, where we feel emotionally taken care of and nurtured, and when we feel a mutual bond, we end up feeling, to be quite frank, we feel pain, fear, hurt, rejection, abandonment, loneliness, disappointment, grief, despair, hopelessness, feeling inadequate. When those emotions kick on a subconscious and sometimes a very conscious physical level, we start looking for comfort. And if we were all perfect, amazing people, you know, perfect saints, yeah, we'd get closer to God, and we'd seek out our partners.
That's when you sit down and read the scriptures.
That's right.
Speak let's for yourself. All right.
Let's just all exercise a little more, and we'll just pray harder, and, you know, we'll feel better about it. And, you know, that's nice. However, usually we don't do those things for two reasons. A, because they take too long and we want to feel better now. Mm-hmm. We're usually desperate. We don't feel happy. And B, we, quite frankly, we may not have a lot of confidence that it's going to last. We want something that's going to be satisfying as an escape, and that we won't have to think. We want to turn our brains off, not turn them on. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times we end up doing bad comforts, you know, things like drugs, sex, alcohol,
food,
eating,
porn,
yeah,
food, yeah, sleep, movies, TV.
I'm food and sleep guy.
Yeah.
Like when my wife goes away for the weekend, that's literally what I'll do.
There you go.
I'm just like, why are you? Okay. I guess I'll eat this.
Right.
Sleep through this.
Right.
And then you'll be back.
And then I don't feel anything.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same process is true of pornography and masturbation and shopping and spending and gambling and anger and emotional distancing and withdrawal and emotional withdrawal. All those things, they're just a quick fix. They're an escape. We're trying desperately to feel better now. So anyway.
So how do we get past that, though? That seems like that's a $1 million question.
Right. So a lot of times people make the mistake of trying to address you know, pornography addictions by the physical trigger. You know, oh, I'm getting turned on now. That's a bad idea. You know, that's not the place to stop it. You're 90% likely to engage in the behavior once you're physically aroused. Instead, where I think people get the most traction, whether they're in a physical addiction, whether they're just emotionally bereft or they're feeling a lack in their life, the place to address it is where the emotional shift occurs, you know, where we go from happy to not so happy, or, you know, even from kind of so-so to crappy, you know, however that happens, wherever the shift occurs, that's where people need help.
So like what though, using the example, like when my wife goes away, you know, she'll sometimes go visit a friend or something like that. And I have, even if it's just an afternoon for the weekend, I'll be like, oh, you know what I should be doing is this and this and this. But I'm like, oh, I wanted to go with you and now I'm going to go eat and sleep. I can't not have her go.
Right.
So then what do you do?
Well, hopefully in the times that she's present, you guys would have a chance to connect on a level that would be more self-sustaining. For example, people think self-care, especially in the church, by the way, people think self-care is selfish. You know, we're supposed to be service-oriented. We're supposed to do everything we can to reach out and rescue the people around us. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really nice until we burn out. Yeah. And then everyone has to rescue us. And that is a destructive pattern from the get-go. I don't believe that's ever what was intended. What we really should be doing is we should be engaging in a process where we can, just like on the when you get on an airplane and you got the air mask that drop down, they don't tell you to take care of the five people around you, even if you're able-bodied. They tell you to put on your own mask. I could save five people, and then I'd be wheezing, and they'd rescue me, you know, whatever. But if I put on my mask, I'll probably save 15 people, and no one has to rescue me. Mm-hmm. It's the same process on a daily basis. We need to be emotionally recharging our battery, refueling our tank, so that we can feel satisfied. And when our partner does go away or when we're left to our own devices, the hope would be that we would at least be a little bit more on target so that we can address our actual need instead of just trying to comfort ourselves in what's missing.
So once you've identified what is sort of your trigger, that emotional trigger you were talking about, what are some suggestions you might have for changing the behavior once you identify what that emotional trigger
is? Let's use my example, right?
Yeah.
So you're hoping then that when my wife and I are around that there's something that's more sustaining. So it's like what? Like,
or like you know that this. you know your wife's going away, so how do you prepare for you are going to feel that loneliness once she goes away? How do you prepare for
right.
that? What do
right.
you do?
So if we're more connected when our partners are present and when we're around, or like when we get home from work at night, if our connection is more than just a superficial, it's nice to see you, this is the crap of my day, just so you know, goodbye, you know, time for bed. That's typically what people do. You know,
right.
they get home and they're exhausted. They fall on the couch. They fall into bed. That's it. The end of the story. Or they put on a movie and they, you know, drain their brain for the next 4 hours and then they fall asleep.
Yeah.
Been there. Done that.
It's really common.
Currently doing that.
I wear the t-shirt. No. So rather than doing that, I believe that though we may be exceptionally busy, in 5 to 10 minutes time, we can connect with our partners on an emotional level that means something. So I'll give you an example. We come home and the typical routine is we dump the problems on each other. And then if we do that at all, sometimes we get so burned out that we don't even do that anymore. We just
right.
come home, we see each other, we grunt, we get something out of the fridge and we start channel flipping. You kid me,
yeah.
done. We're done. And then, you know, and it's just classic, you know, in a moment like that when a lot of men, out of a very real emotional search that they're on, they'll just turn to their partner looking for affection. And their wife is like, are you kidding me? get away from me.
not
going to happen. Not even close.
Yeah.
And the man's like, well, what are you talking about? I'm trying to get closer. But of course, he doesn't use those words. That's like another language for a man. We don't use those language. But anyway.
Those words.
Words, yeah, we don't do
that. And I love that they think that that physical thing is like what we need too. No. We don't need that.
Right.
We need to talk to you. Like,
right.
we want to know that you're there, that you see us, you still think we're beautiful. I don't need you to do that.
Right. Well, on that very issue, just as a little sidestep, but I think it's kind of all related, is that there's that, you know, stereotypical, and there's books about this. It's not like I came up with this myself, but there's that stereotypical model where, women, they want to feel, you know, well, I'm trying to think. I don't want to offend anybody here. So be careful.
Just go right ahead. Yeah. We don't get offended.
So women want to feel emotionally bonded so that they can feel safe enough to then physically connect. Affection
Amen,
is...
Amen,
oh
brother.
I am so
Amen,
offended.
Brother. No, that he hit it on the head.
And so then they can feel like, you know, they can take a sigh of relief. They feel like, okay, I am connected. Affection makes sense to me. I can engage. I can evolve myself. Everything's good to go. And ironically, stereotypically for men, what usually happens is they need to have a sense of affection first. And once they have that in return from their partner, then they feel safe enough to open up their vulnerable side and be emotionally engaged. And so it's like this game of chicken. Like, the man wants, you know, the sex first and the affection and the kissing and the hand-holding. And the woman is like, no, you tell me all your feelings first. And so, like, there's this,
like,
you know, back and forth.
My marriage right
So, like, what do you do, right? And obviously, you know, there has to be some give and take where a husband and a wife can agree to engage in what the other person actively needs, so that both people's needs become, you know, confluent. And the great part is, once you kind of do give in just a little bit so that the other person can feel what they need, both people will be mutually serving. And it'll become a relationship that's more interacting, more bonding, and it'll feel better. Because both of you will be getting exactly what you both want. Women do want affection. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, men get the idea of like, well, my wife's an ice princess. She doesn't want any of this. I can tell. She always says no. Well, no, idiot. She just doesn't want it the way you're giving it.
Mm-hmm. So, amen, brother. Amen.
Now I'm offended.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when it comes to, you know, how do I do this on a daily basis, there's hands-on things that you really can do. But when you come home at night, the secret isn't to, you know, come to your partner and say, well, this is my problems, and then expect a solution. The answer isn't, as the receiver, you know, if your partner comes home and you're the one listening to the stuff, your part isn't to roll your eyes and say, yeah, well, if you had any idea what my day was like, then, you know, you wouldn't be complaining right now, because I could tell you 100 things and kind of one up to you. That's not going to help either, which is exceptionally common, by the way. What will help
now
is...
Now I'm offended.
Done and done. What will help is, you come home, you leave logic and reasoning at the door, because they don't help, and you stop trying to solve problems and be the fixer, and instead you genuinely empathize. There's a magic to empathy when both people are actually engaged, interested, and validating in each other. So you start talking about the things that matter, and there's a difference between surface emotion and core emotion. I'm on a soapbox. You have to stop me at any time.
No, no, that's fascinating.
Okay. Keep going, because in the second or in the third block, we're going to talk all about just terrible relationships. So I like the good stuff now, and we'll get to the bad in a minute.
Fair enough. So surface emotions, these are things like anger, irritable, frustrated, mad, rage, jealous, even the sarcastic, flippant stuff. You know, the shutting down, the walling off, all of that stuff is surface emotion kind of stuff, right? And behaviors. But they are a mask for what we're experiencing on a deeper level. And again, like I was mentioning before, those core feelings, they can be peace, love, joy, and the good things, genuine happiness, mixed with fear and pain and hurt and rejection, abandonment, loneliness, disappointment, grief, and feeling inadequate. All those things. So we feel those core things first, and then we show them on the surface. And so if your partner's being cold, distant, shut down, rejecting, disinterested, disengaged, there's a reason for it. It's not just that my partner's a jerk. They're experiencing something, or did experience something on the core level, mm-hmm. that we've got to tap into. Now, they may not know what it is. A lot of times people just don't have that kind of a fluency in that verbiage. They don't know how to put it in words. They'd like to, but
so
they don't
know. So how do you figure it out then? Or how do you better the situation?
So ideally, we would all just do this magically. We'd have this, you know, gift inside us that we accessed, and, you know, I found it. I figured it out. You know, a lot of times people need to go to a counselor so they can kind of learn the language, so to speak. And you can do it that way too. Obviously, I'm a believer in counseling. When I was back east, the stigma was that if you didn't have a counselor, you were weird. You know, it's like, you don't have a shrink?
That's not
I don't
the
know.
Case in Mormonism, I don't think, at
no,
all.
No, I think kind of in the, you know, Western states, the feeling is kind of more independent. You know, I can do this on my own. You know, I'm out here on the frontier and all kind of
well,
a thing.
Well, I think especially in the church, too, we're all supposed to be okay. You know, you're supposed to
self-reliant,
pray and figure it out, you know? And,
right.
And I don't think it's that simple,
how's
like
that
we're
working?
Saying. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think it's a huge mistake. You know, the divorce rate isn't any less in the church than it is nationwide. And there's a reason for that. And that's because the problems don't just stop at the church door. Mm-hmm. They continue everywhere. We're all experiencing the same stuff. And it isn't about whether or not I have enough faith. Some people have excellent faith, really, really strong, solid core beliefs, but they don't know what to do with the day-to-day challenges where we get tripped up, just like everyone in and out of the church does. So, again, ideally, we'd have a chance to connect with each other. You know, we'd come home 5-10 minutes, and we'd drop down our defenses. We'd have mutually unguarded and intentionally vulnerable time, where we're not defensive, we're not trying to justify ourselves away. There's no need to, because we're both going to be sensitive to each other, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to empathize, which is a step better than sympathy. Sympathy's a card, I hate that. You know, I feel bad for you. Here's homework. Said it so. Here's a card. You have it. Empathy means I'm actually seeing the world from your shoes. We're going to show empathy on purpose. And when we do that, then we give our partners permission to do the same. And their guard comes down. We actually talk about the core stuff. So in other words, we may start out saying like, yeah, I'm really tired today. I had a crappy day at work. And this is why. It's because I felt disappointed with the way it all went down. I felt disrespected by my boss. I felt like the people around me really didn't appreciate the effort I brought. Or I may have felt really lonely. I may have felt really kind of detached, and I just wanted to be near someone that cared about me. And once you put that out there, that gives your partner this golden opportunity to do something with it. There's nothing your partner's going to do with anger except to get defensive. What are they going to do with that? Nothing. Mm-hmm. Even if you say that you're all burned out and you're irritated, well, again, what are they going to do with that? There's nothing to do. But if you say, yeah, today I felt really kind of inadequate, or I felt really frustrated and kind of unappreciated, they can do something with that.
What if there's one person that is constantly opening up like that and the other one sort of isn't? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Like, I think of it more like
what if there's a woman who's always constantly...
What if I am always... Hypothetically. No, my husband is so great at identifying the surface problem and then figuring out what's underneath it. He's really good at that. But I can see that there would be some people with situations like that where the woman might typically be like, I feel this way, I feel this way. And the husband's like, yeah, football. What's up?
Right. Me, Tarzan, you, Jane.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, and I don't think people necessarily do that on purpose. See, we're a product of our culture, and I don't just mean the culture of, the United States or even the culture of the church, although that matters too. I consider it culture of the family you grew up in. There's a family culture that develops and that we're developed through. And so, one person's experience in the church or in a family situation could be very different from another. And so I grew up with a kind of a set understanding of how communication happens because of the way I was raised. My wife has a very different one. And that's normal that to have that difference. The secret to it is both of you learning the language together. And the way you can do that is, on the very light, kind of, let's just gently tiptoe into this area. There's some self-help books that are fantastic. One of my favorite books of all time is called Hold Me Tight. I know, it's a cheesy title. If you can get past the title.
Who's it by?
Sue Johnson. Okay. It's fantastic. It's
Hold
excellent.
Hold Me Tight.
Hold Me Tight.
Get it at all the regular places?
Uh-huh. You can get it on Amazon. On our website, there's a list of my favorite books. It's
What's
top book.
What's your website?
Oh. AmberCreekCounseling.com. If you go there, there's a helpful links tab, and there's some excellent books there that I would recommend to anybody.
I want to see every boy listening to this podcast right now with a Hold Me Tight book in his hand.
That's right. I can't wait till the next page.
Or exactly. On his Kindle. Or on.
If you're not a reader, they have it on audiobooks. So you can listen on the way to work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's handy.
There you go.
There you go. Boom.
So anyway, so you learn the language together, and then if one person kind of is more fluent in it than the other person, you kind of help each other figure it out. And if you're the more fluent partner, you kind of suggest, you kind of just throw it out there gently, not in an accusing or I figured you out way.
You won't do this. I figured this out, and you're not even trying.
Yeah.
That's not going to work out so well.
No, I don't think so.
No. And remember, there's a difference between judging someone and assessing a circumstance, right? Judging means you're determining whether or not their core value has, maintained itself. You suck now. I've judged you.
Yeah.
Versus I'm assessing the situation. It's not working out this way or that way, So you can assess the situation. Maybe just throw out a gentle wondering. You can say like this, like, honey, you seem like you're really mad right now. I'm just wondering, did something happen earlier today that set you off? And just put it out there gently. Let them fill it in. And if they know, great. And maybe they don't know.
He's like, no, I just hate you, okay?
No,
just leave
me
alone.
And if that's all they can bring,
going on.
If that's all they can bring to the table, roll with it. Like, okay, honey, I hear you. It's like, is it more important to be right or is it more important to be married? And I think a lot of times people are convinced that if they're going to have a conversation work out well, there has to be a right and a wrong. With empathy, there is no right and wrong. You can empathize with someone that you 100% completely disagree with. If my wife came home and said, this guy's green today, and I was just outside like 5 seconds ago, and I know full well that it's blue. I saw it. I can sit there and argue with her. I could even drag her by the arm and force her and say, look, it is blue. I'm right. You're wrong. And I'd still lose because I lost the moment. I won the argument. I lost the moment. And instead, the empathy way to do it is I look at her and I say, take a deep breath. And I say,
you're cute.
No, don't patronize that.
You're such a cute.
I don't think that works.
Pretty bad.
I'd look at her and I'd say, honey, I get it. That's what you saw. for you, that's exactly what it was. I can appreciate that.
Okay, but you are not most guys. Okay, no, most guys are going to say, it's green, you're an idiot.
and that would be blue, one of the 50 best ways to make sure you don't have sex. That,
okay,
there you go.
Okay, perfect.
All right, so coming back in the third block, I want to dive full into the other side. Now we've kind of talked about those relationships that, you know, we can make them better, the taking a few minutes and some of that. And I'm betting that a lot of that will apply into what we're going to talk about here in a minute. But I want to talk about if you have found yourself in an abusive relationship, or if you've been abused in the past, we're going to talk all about abuse. That's coming up here in the third block.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
All right, it's time for the third block of the Cultural Hall, and let's just get right into it. I want to talk about abuse. Here is a question from our Facebook page. This person says, as a single sister, what signs are there when dating to be aware of? It seems so prevalent today, or maybe more people are just talking about it, but how can I avoid the entrapment of abuse? So I guess maybe before we get into answering that question, let's talk about the different kinds of abuse that can occur in a relationship.
Sure. So there are a number of different kinds. When we say abuse, usually people figure that we're talking about, sexual abuse of a child, or people will assume that automatically means like domestic abuse in a marriage, mm-hmm. that we're hitting each other. And those are both relevant, of course, but it does go bigger than that. There can be sexual abuse for adults. There can be...
like how? What would sexual abuse for adults be?
Oh, forcing your partner into sexual practices that they had no interest in doing, or even being demeaning in certain ways sexually to kind of garner control over them. That's pretty common as well. Other things are, verbal abuse, mental abuse, emotional abuse. Anyway, so financial abuse, frankly, of
what would financial abuse be? I've never.
So that happens a lot with elderly folks, where adult children will just kind of take control of and kind of how do I say this? Put your adult parent in their place, so to speak. Well, you're incompetent. You're not going to be able to do this.
I have that happening in my family, by the way. Well, it's with my husband's family, but yeah just the daughter is like living at the grandma's house right now and just kind of sucking her dry and she doesn't even know she's doing it.
Yeah. Really sad stuff. And it happens with middle-aged young couples as well. One partner will become the financial dominating force and the other person just has to live with it. And there's nothing healthy about that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so there's all these different parts of the spectrum, right? I would hope that people would pay more mind to these kinds of things. There's relevant things to say as far as noticing the triggers ahead of time. There's also some real value, I think, to discussing kind of in community groups about what really helps when you know that abuse is happening. You know, a lot of times we mean well and we think that we're going to do the perfect golden nugget of truth thing that's going to help, fix
now
it.
Now I'm empowered.
Right.
Now I can overcome this abuse.
Right. Well, and you'll notice that, I feel like I'm getting on a tangent here, but as we notice couples that are in domestic violence, a lot of times the efforts we make to try and stop them from get a battered woman out of a household, the more she'll want to stay, and she'll defend her partner, and she'll say no, you don't understand. If you knew them like I knew them, or if you could see the potential that I see, mm-hmm. or if you knew how much this really means to me, you wouldn't say anything. You'd back off. And so the more we push, the less good it'll do in most cases. That really isn't the answer. I heard one of these, one of the best professors I ever heard. She did a lot of research. She devoted her life into domestic violence. And she had an experience where she was standing in line at a movie theater and there was a younger couple in their mid-20s in front of her. And they were just looking back and forth at the movies they wanted to watch and the male figure. And that's not always the man, by the way. That's important to point out. Sometimes women can be abusive to men physically, sexually, emotionally, in a lot of different ways. That's very real. So it's not just the stereotypical man on woman kind of stuff. It can go reverse. So anyway, she was watching this couple and they were talking back and forth. And at one point, I don't know if she had chosen a movie that he didn't want to see or if she said something that was really embarrassing to him or something. And he turned around and he just slapped her to the ground.
What?
And she just fell right down to the ground. And this professor that I had, she was right behind that. Of course, she's a domestic violence expert, right? She knows this stuff. And she didn't go up to them and say, "How dare you?" And she didn't get in his face and yell. She didn't do all those things, which automatically would have kicked on the defense mechanisms in the woman. Instead, what she did was, as soon as the woman stood, and it was just so classic to watch. It was just textbook, because the girl who had been slapped, she stood up, she wiped her face off, she quickly brushed herself off, she looked around so that no one would notice, and then she kind of looked forward, you know, so that she could be just back to normal again, everything back to normal. And my professor, she walked right up behind her, she tapped her on the arm, she looked at her square in the eye, and she said, "I saw that, and it's not okay." And she left. She didn't say another word. You know, and she said it to the abused, not to the abuser. And she just wanted to point it out. Well, interestingly enough, that same woman tracked her down. She found
really?
Her later. Yeah,
really?
She found her later, and she told her that she'd gotten out of the relationship and that pivotal moment was what got her out. Because someone planted the seed for her to know the difference. And so she could figure it out for herself. That, in an unguarded, she had no reason to be defensive, right? Because someone else is just sharing their insight of what they saw briefly, and then they stepped away.
Oh, I would not have handled that situation that way. Yeah.
No, it's so different, right?
I mean, it seems very counterintuitive, because especially in a lot of abuse situations, you're like, "Oh, I fear for the life maybe of this person.
Right.
I need to be, wait, I can, what if I'm, you know, if I didn't say something, then this person may end up dead," or, you know.
Right. And if it happens to a child, I mean, screw the pattern. You know, yeah. If a parent whacks their child in front of me, I'm going to speak to the parent. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
I can't help my, it's going to happen. But when it comes to battered women, a lot of times it's not what we think is going to help. That's the best thing. Sometimes we have to help them see past the pattern that's holding them bound.
So if you're not there in the necessarily the case, the instant when something happens, but you know that person confides in you saying, "Hey, this is something that has existed. This has happened before." Then what do you do?
Point it out, just gently, without being accusatory, without assessing their entire marriage and telling them, "Well, you just need to leave them and everything's over and done with." Just assess the moment and tell them the honest feedback of the moment. "What you just described to me sounds wrong. That doesn't sound fair at all. That sounds very unhealthy. I just want you to know." And then move on. Let them know that. It'll percolate in their mind. That has sometimes the greatest impact of anything you could say. But anyway, back to what you were saying before, that person on the comment on the Facebook, they were looking for signs and triggers. There are some great books for this out there. I'm not going to lie.
What are they?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. I'll have to think about this for a minute.
Can I find them at Amber Creek Counseling?
There are some books there. On this particular issue, it'll come to me. I'll think about this in a second. But some things just right off the bat that I would look for. If you're in a dating situation, things to watch for is any addictive history that the partner doesn't want to talk about or feels there was no need to get treatment for. That kind of an arrogant, "I can handle it myself," is not a good sign. Now, however, that doesn't mean that if someone has had an addictive past, that means that they're lost. They can be a great partner. They could be a fantastic husband, wife, the whole deal. But they should have a sense of humility to be able to talk it through, explain it out, and seek out help, even on a continuum if need be. But kind of an arrogant dismissal of the issue, that's a problem. Other things I'd watch for is how they treat their family members when they're completely at ease. We're one way when we're in public, sure. But when we're at home in a home setting and a home scenario where no one else is watching and we're with people that are probably going to love us for decades anyway because we're family, mm-hmm. How we act there, that can say a lot. So, how are they with their parents? How are they with their siblings? How are they with their nieces and nephews? How are they with their kids if they have kids? Pay attention behind closed doors. You know, what's happening? And other things I'd watch for is, are they able to calm themselves when they get agitated? Or do they require an exterior stimulus to make that happen? Do they have to like instantly turn on music? Do they have to go for a drive? Do they have to punch a wall or a door? Do they have to slam a door? Do they have to slam something down on the table? Or are they able to, if they get really mad and agitated, and you don't want to push them to see it, but
let's see how this goes. You're not dealing with this well.
You punched a wall. You should probably get help with that.
No, if you're able to see them in a moment of agitation, can they bring themselves back to center? Or at least do they know how to do it in a way that's helpful? And if they can, that's a great sign. If they can't, I would at least talk it through. I'd ask them, I'd point it out to them and say, you know, when you got really mad, that looked like it could have gone anywhere. I had no idea. It was a total, you know, wild card. I didn't know where you were going. You know, either literally or emotionally. I didn't know. And if you're ever in an I don't know where you're going state, that needs to be addressed. That would, for me, would be a red flag. Not impossible to deal with. Now, it doesn't mean that your partner's disposable and they're done, but it means that it's warranted. It warrants a conversation. So there's a great center, actually, for if you ever find yourself in a domestic violence situation, Cornerstone Counseling. I'm not afraid to recommend other counseling centers. I know that they're really good at it. They have some excellent domestic violence specialists there that I'd send you to. But anyway, as we've talked about, there's lots of different kinds of abuse. I would just maybe throw out one that we don't usually think of, and that is guilt trips and emotional manipulation. Did you ever see the movie Tangled? I don't know if you saw that.
The princess one,
yeah,
right?
It's about Rapunzel.
I haven't seen it, but I heard of it, yeah.
It was excellent. You actually should see it. I thought it was actually really funny. It came out a few years ago. There's just a classic interaction between Rapunzel and her mother, and they made the witch mother, you know, that hag of a woman, very emotionally manipulative. She would say things in a very icky sweet kind of a way, but then she'd mix into it, kind of in a weave, she'd say things that were emotionally demeaning or that kind of put Rapunzel in her place. Anyway, if you ever find yourself having someone cross over emotional boundaries, you need to do something about it. And this can be things, it can be people, you know, anyway. See, you got to be careful. I get on soapboxes and yeah, I can't stop.
So what do you do, though? So you find yourself, I mean, in that case, obviously, if you're just dating, you know, you can be like, okay, here's a red flag that, you know, we tried to work through. I'm not married to this person and I'm out. But if you're married, you know, and you want it to be, maybe you got kids or, you know, you genuinely love the person. I think that's where the conflict comes, is it's like, right. Oh man, I genuinely love this person and this relationship is bad for me. Like, we can love things that are bad for us.
Sure. Sure.
So how do you get, you know, how can you put yourself in that mind where it's like, okay, I love this, but, or I love this person, but in enabling yourself to love yourself more.
No, absolutely. And that's a big point. Just like with the airline thing we talked about before, you have to take care of you so that you can be a better partner and parent. If you burn out, either because you have no more energy or because you're being exhausted emotionally from your marriage, your kids aren't going to have anything left. So you're absolutely right. So the thing to do there is you need to bring it up. You need to have a conversation. But I would just recommend that you not make it about the abusive partner. I know that sounds counterintuitive again, because they're the ones that are bringing the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, if need be, if they're physically abusive, I mean, sure, of course, absolutely, you bring it up and you say, what you're doing isn't right. And, you know, I support you 100% in saying those kinds of things. Set the boundary, draw the line in the sand, let them hear it. That's important. You should have a voice. However, if these are things like that are maybe on the milder spectrum, like they're kind of taking all the control in the finances, or if they are frequently saying things that are kind of grating to you emotionally or demeaning to you, and maybe they realize it, maybe they don't, or if they consistently kind of disregard your feelings on something or your opinions or whatever, then I would bring it up. But I would do it like this. I'd bring it up in the sense that this is what I need. And I know for myself, I've done some thinking for me, and for me to be my best, happiest self, I really need us to communicate better. I need to be heard on some of these things. And don't make it about, look what you did, look who you are, because they're going to become instantly defensive. They're not going to hear you out. They're going to totally turn you off, and they're going to become more and more entrenched in their patterns. So you bring it up in the sense of, this is what I need, and then let them do something with it. Okay, I guess my wife really just wants to talk this out. Fine, you know, and they can have the conversation. And if you can do it by yourselves, the two of you, great. If you can't, go to a counselor. There's nothing wrong with that. Counseling is not for the broken. It's for people that have good relationships that want a better one.
Do you think a lot of the time the abuser, not necessarily physically, but more talking about emotional abuse here, doesn't realize that they're doing it?
Yes. Absolutely.
I just had a very, I'm not in any way saying my husband emotionally abuses me, but sure. The other day, I was just really annoyed at him because he kept criticizing me. He just kept like picking out things that I was doing wrong, and it really bothered me. So like, he did it one more time and I made some sassy comment like, anything else I'm doing wrong today? You know, and just like one of those like sarcastic comments. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was doing that. Like he didn't know. He didn't know that he was criticizing me as much until I pointed it out to him.
Right.
So I guess this isn't really a question, more just you should point it out.
Right.
Because then they'll notice it.
But again, point it out in terms of what your experience of it was.
Right, I shouldn't have been so sassy. I get that. I recognize that now.
Look how you suck, honey.
Yeah. Anything else I'm doing wrong, sweetheart? Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, sarcasm again is a surface communication tool. It doesn't get to the core of it. If I were in your shoes, I'd probably have the same concern. And I would, in an ideal situation, we're not going to always be ideal. I talk about these things in terms of like lofty,
Kirk,
perfect.
The old relationship pro here. I'm sure that there are, no, and that's the thing. I appreciate that you point that out, though, that I'm sure that your wife would say, yeah, but.
Yeah,
he does.
We don't have a perfect marriage. We don't do it all the right way. We may know some good tips and tools because they're in our common conversation all the time. I talk to her about things that work, things that don't. That's in our vernacular, but we're a work in progress too. Absolutely. There's no such thing as a perfect couple. People say, well, we never once argued in our 80 years. Wonderful for you. But I have to wonder if there was something wrong there. or they remember the past with rose-colored glasses. So, healthy relationships disagree. Healthy relationships have, you know, kind of conflict in ideas. That's normal. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's healthy. It's just what we do with it once it pops up. And a lot of times we get stuck in a pattern of we've been in conflict so many times. Or we've been down this road 100,000 times. Same old stuff. And we just get so burned out by it that we just figure it's not going to get better. Why talk about it? That isn't the solution. It's exhaustion. It's not the solution. So.
I want to go down this avenue just a little bit more. I think that there is oftentimes, because men work, men are the ones that provide and make the money, and then women...
Although less and less and less so.
I love how you like looked at me like I might be offended by
this. No.
It's okay. We get it.
Although less and less, sure. But it seems like in a lot of these situations that you hear about, that the woman stayed with the man because he kind of holds all the cards.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. A lot of times they feel kind of bound to them either out of necessity or out of some sense of obligation.
So if there's people that are listening that they know, yeah, okay, I know this isn't okay. I've tried to talk to him and had, you know, the opportunity, let's go see a counselor. And he's saying, no, I'm not, I don't want to do this. But they still feel like it's like, I have three kids with him and I want my kids to have a dad and I don't have a job. I never finished college or whatever. I mean, what in that situation?
So, it's hard to say, you know, without knowing the person and the circumstance exactly what to do, because I think it's on a spectrum again. And some people who are in horrific abusive marriages, I'm not afraid to say that sometimes staying married isn't the answer. You know, I can point that out sometimes. It's really there. Now, I'm a marriage and family therapist. Obviously, I believe in marriage. And my first goal would be to help people to enjoy their marriage, stay married. But the honest truth is, if your partner's refusing to get help and change, absolutely refuses to get help, and the cost then is that you will not be happy and your children will have a battered household, get out. I mean, why stay with that? What possible good can that serve you? And I don't think that there'd be any real guilt or fault in wanting to be done in that circumstance. However, it's really important that people at least exhaust the avenue of what can I do before going that route, right? Because a lot of times people are in the position that they're in because they don't know any better. So let them learn. People can learn. Try first. I have like three things in my head. I don't want to deviate from your course. All right. So
go wherever.
We're just listening, taking it in.
So if your partner is physically abusive, what I would recommend to you is I'd have an escape route. You know, I'd have some things kind of set up in advance. I'd have a small bag, some clothes, extra set of duplicate car keys and house keys, because sometimes you get locked out. And
Bank account information,
absolutely. I'd have about $200, and if you can swing it. And I'd have an extra pay-as-you-go cell phone with some prepaid minutes. And I'd have an extra set of clothing for you and your kids. And I'd have that bag of things, and a copy of all of your important documents. I'd have a bag of those small things kept at a neutral location, a friend's house, that just say, hey, can you just hold on to this for me? And you don't have to give them this long story. You don't have to explain it. Just kind of stash it away so that in the event that something happens, you can safely walk away and not be completely lost. You'll have at least a place to go and think for a little while. Grab a hotel, go to a friend's house, and just kind of sit back and think it through. However, for a lot of us who we may be in the situation, we want it to get better, we don't know what to do, but it doesn't rise to the level of running away. In those circumstances, it's really important that you have a voice and that you matter enough to speak up. You know, I often tell people that we don't express our emotions for the benefit of how they're going to respond to us. We really express ourselves for us. We're the reason. We mattered enough that we had a voice. We said our piece. We expressed ourselves. And if they respond well, if they hear us out and listen and give a good feedback or whatever, that's just a bonus. But they may not. It's the same thing with your boss. You know, you're still going to speak your mind if you're healthy. If someone offends you, you speak up. They may be too stupid or completely uncaring to do anything with it, but you've said your piece. So it's the same thing in this circumstance. You know, you have to matter enough to have a voice. Self-esteem is a big issue in this stuff. And a lot of times, you know, can I take that back? I hate the word self-esteem.
Okay, taken back.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Did you hear me?
No, I don't even know what that word means.
I hate that word.
I'm so glad you said that because I feel the same way. I much prefer self-worth and self-efficacy. I think they're more in tune with what people really are about. And maybe it's semantics, but I think that there's some problems with self-esteem anyway. But self-worth is a big deal. And if we don't have it, a lot of our relationship will end up feeling hollow, and it'll end up being a shadow of what it could be.
So how do we do it?
Have self-worth, you mean?
Yeah.
So, oh my, all right.
Come on, get back up on the soapbox.
Speak about soapbox, here we go.
Down.
Yeah, I guess. All right, so self-worth, from a church perspective, I guess I could start there. Yeah. There was this person that you might be familiar with, Ezra Taft Benson had a quote once.
Heard of him, yeah.
he said something.
President, I think.
Yeah, yeah. President of something or other. Yeah. Yeah.
Beard?
Yeah. Have a beard? No, he didn't have
a beard.
Secretary of Agriculture, right?
Isn't that's what it was. Right. Yeah. That's right.
I think he indicated
Cabinet under
once.
Eisenhower, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, perfect.
He indicated once that self-esteem is best achieved through a close relationship with God. That's the church perspective on it, which is valid. But I think what it comes down to, and if we can kind of just read between the lines on that, what it really means is self-worth is dependent on an idea of an unchangeable, immutable worthiness of ourself that isn't up for negotiation. It isn't up for discussion. We matter anyway. There has to be this idea within us, and a lot of us don't have it, mm-hmm. that good, bad, no matter what we do, what we produce, what we achieve in this life, that we're still valuable, that we have an unchangeable and irrefutable value within us. And that's what it's about. The closer we are to God, the more we're going to feel that, because that's certainly the way that God feels about us, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be, even for folks that aren't religious. That same concept is true because if we really matter, if we really are valuable, which we are valuable innately. I can't tell you how many times I fight with people about that during the week, during sessions. It's just a really hard concept.
People just saying that they're not worth anything?
They're convinced of it. I mean, 100% hook, line, and sinker. They know they suck. They
how
know
do you get
that
people who don't believe in God to...
To believe in an irrefutable worth.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So that's a challenge. But how do I say this? The core of the discussion doesn't require God. It's just made more. It's more easily understood through God. The real discussion is: am I a person that can be replaced? No. And I know that's so cliche, like, oh, you're irreplaceable to me. Well, it's really true. We are a product of everything that we've learned through experience, our nature, our nurture, our biochemical makeup, the whole thing. We are a package equation that no one else will duplicate. They cannot, based on our experiences. It's impossible. And so what we bring to the table through our talents, our gifts, our understanding of ourselves and other people, our compassion, our knowledge base mixed with our experiences, with how we've interacted with other people, who cared about us when we were little, who did we care about, all those things. Anyway, all of it sums up into a unique footprint that's ours. And because we really can't be duplicated, that means, and I don't believe in chance myself, I believe that everyone we cross in our path, to a degree, crosses our path for a reason, right? So we come across people, we talk with them, we interact with them, and they glean from us, we glean from them, we serve them, we don't serve them. Everything, there's a purpose with it. And so if I have a value that has nothing to do with how good I am at my job, has nothing to do with how good a communicator I am, or with whether or not I went to Stanford, or whether or not I make, you know, $100,000 a year. If I'm just valuable anyway, then it doesn't seem to matter, you know, because as I interact with someone, maybe what they needed from me wasn't my $100,000 a year answer. Maybe what they needed from me was my compassion. Maybe what they needed from me in that moment was my seat on the bus that I gave to them. Maybe what they needed from me was my smile when I looked at them and I looked past whatever clothes they were wearing. Those things may sound cheesy and simple, but I'm using the simplest of examples for something that really is much more complex. And that is, our value isn't determined by anyone else or anything else or any behavior. It really is already there. And if we can embrace that idea, just that beginning concept, then self-worth isn't so far out of reach. Because, so there's a difference now between...
Holy cow, I've never heard anyone break it down like
that. I know,
right? That was like deep, man.
Just grabbing notes.
Okay, write this down.
Wait for it. You guys are going to fall asleep before I'm done.
No, that's fascinating. I didn't know there were so many levels to it.
So there's these two kind of... basic levels, then there's our self-worth, which are those things that we can't get rid of, and we certainly can't, I mean, we can try and undo, you know, I'm going to ruin my compassion today, you know, I'm going to not be good at talking to people today, you know, I mean, we can try that, yeah, forget it.
But we're going to be awkward today.
But our value as a person, as a human, is there, right? And so, our self-worth is there as far as our immutable value. And then on top of that will come what we achieve, what we accomplish, how we reach out, what we can produce in our jobs, compliments we will receive, and other things like that. And all of that comes down to our self-efficacy, right? So I consider that kind of another level of this whole discussion, right? Our self-efficacy is how efficient and how effective and successful can I be at what I tried and endeavor to do. And then, you know, people can give us compliments and praise and acceptance on top of that, which is just, hey, that's great. That's
awesome.
That's extra. But anyway, if all of our lives is based on our self-efficacy, that's where my worth is coming from. I'm convinced of it. Well, you're doomed. You're destined for it to fall apart. Because eventually you will get hit by a car and become, you know, paralyzed, heaven forbid. Or you will lose that one magical job where you can just produce everything you wanted. Or your children will grow up and leave your house and now you're going to be an empty nester. Now what are you going to produce? Or you will have a partner that will pass away or leave you. Or you will be that person who becomes ill 3 or 4 or 5 times a year. And during that time, you just are an absolute worthless blob of a person. You know, if it's all based on what you can produce, all of those times are weak spots, not right. To mention every other little flip-flop thing that happens during the day that can make our day harder. But if our value is already there, and then we do the best we can, our self-efficacy is the best we can bring that day in that circumstance, and we're superstars.
How do you know, though, that you are to that level that you could sustain some of those bad things happening to you? Because I feel like I've had a very charmed life, knock on wood, that there will be, you know, like I haven't had many terrible things happen to me. And I sort of sometimes feel like, when's the other shoe going to drop? You know, so how do I know that I've prepared myself emotionally for if it does drop? Do you know what I mean?
You can't. Okay, you're not going to know exactly.
Good to know. Yeah. I'm screwed.
There's no such thing as the perfect.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope it's done enough.
No, you're not going to know for sure, you know, with any clarity or certainty. It's not going to happen. However, I do believe that you can have a sense of peace day to day. The big picture package, well, that's going to be something that you're going to know when you're 60 on that, 40 anniversary cruise, or if, you're sitting on the front porch with the lemonade and you're looking back, well, I have had a good life. I know. But day to day, you're not going to know that because we're too much in it. But I think on a today basis, I think we can know. And that's really what self-care really comes down to, is am I taking care of myself today enough so that if my day just totally crumbles in front of me, that I'm not going to be a total wreck? Am I going to be able to pick myself back up? Am I going to be able to still care about my kids? Am I going to be able to pick up the shambles of whatever, you know, horrible family reunion interaction we just had, you know, for the last 4 hours? Am I going to be able to pick myself back up?
Nope. I'd like to think that God knows those things that we can't handle and he doesn't give them to us, because...
Right. Yeah, it's nice to think.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't think that's the case, though.
Well, like, I know
you know that whole God never gives you anything that you can't handle?
Right.
Sometimes I think it's like, nah, he's going to give you this and he's going to teach you how you're going to handle it.
Well, there's that, but I also think, I don't know what I think.
I want to get to this last question, then we got to wrap this out. being outside of the church for a few years seems to have made me able to see things as they are. My question is, why are there so many girls in the church that believe that once they are married, it is their duty to have sex with their husbands whenever they want? Is this just kind of a culture or learned thing? It can't be rape because they're married, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow, talk about leaving the volatile for the last. There,
right?
You go.
So wait, am I supposed to feel this way? Because I don't really.
You don't? That's weird.
No, I don't know.
So I do believe that there's kind of... and I believe it's more so in past generations. I think it's less so, less and less so as generations are getting married now. But there has been kind of this this understanding that in a marriage situation, you're supposed to give yourself to the other person, and that's not supposed to be something you have to keep earning, because, well, now you're married. And if you're going to be a good partner, well, man up, you know, do what you do, get to the table and bring what you're supposed to bring, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. And it's a flawed way of thinking. It is. It has nothing to do with a healthy relationship. But I think it came from kind of a closed-minded, kind of an overtly conservative perspective in the past, that that people believe that this is just the way it is. I don't believe at all that it's the way it's supposed to be. And this is actually interesting. I've had a couple to go the exact opposite direction. The woman was the high sex drive partner, and the man that I was working with several years ago, the man just couldn't match it. And they would come in and he would just sob. He's like, I can't satisfy her. It doesn't seem to matter. And she just wants to, you know, have sex again. And it's like over and over. And she's like, man up, you know, wimp, you know, come on. And she had a flavor for special names, she called him. But
jeez, that's the problem right there.
But whether it's the man demanding it or whether the woman demanding it, sex is supposed to be something that you intentionally share as kind of like it's a reminder of what's good. It's not supposed to be an end result. It's not supposed to be, you know, expected, and it's certainly not supposed to be your prime focus. But I heard it explained once. I like this explanation, but I heard it explained like this once, that if you were to look at like a square bedroom, and you had one of those like old school light bulbs hanging down on a chain, you know, like those old interrogation mm-hmm. rooms, you know,
yeah.
You had a little light bulb hanging down in the room. Our life is like that bedroom, right? And that light bulb hanging down, its surface area and its mass in the room is kind of equivalent to how sex should be in our life. There's a big area in that room, right? And the sex is kind of a relatively small part of it. You know, it's not going to be 24/7. You're not going to have sex 6 times a day. Good luck with that. It's just not going to happen in a marriage. Newsflash. <You know? laughs> But in that relatively small portion of the room, in terms of mass, what's interesting is that when it's working right, it illuminates everything. It makes everything better if it's had in balance. And so when we expect that our marriage is going to be, you know, a spotlight, you know, a room full of light bulbs, we're setting ourselves up for some disappointment. Sex should be something, intimacy in general, emotional intimacy, physical intimacy, and there are varied kinds of intimacy. It's not all one or the other. And they all come hand in hand, by the way. But intimacy in general is something that can be achieved and then mutually enjoyed. And I think it's disturbing to me how many couples end up in different bedrooms. Mm-hmm. Or different beds, in that, you know, sometimes same bedroom but two twin beds, just different parts of the house. And, you know, people think like, oh, yeah, right, that doesn't happen, you know, or not in my ward, or, you know, not in my family. It's a lot more common than you think. And it comes down to, you know, somewhere along the line, there was a disagreement. Somewhere along the line, I didn't get along with my partner for this or that, or they had back surgery, or they snore too much. And so that's how it starts, right? But then we stay apart, and we don't have any more physical intimacy with each other anymore. And people wonder, why, how did that happen? I believe it's because we didn't take care of the stuff that makes physical intimacy happen. We didn't take care of the emotional stuff. We didn't take care of the connective bond that really we can. And I know that sounds like so cheesy, and it just sounds like a, you know, talk show answer. But the truth of it is, intimacy, whether you're the high sex drive partner or the low sex drive partner, and usually there's one of each in a marriage. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there's no problem.
Yeah, right. Otherwise, things are good.
Exactly. But whether you're the high sex drive or the low sex drive partner, what's interesting to me is that consistently, when partners get connected on the things that really matter, when they really are accessible to each other on an emotional level, when they really are actively engaged with each other, when they really are reachable with each other, and they really are kind of helping to fill in those emotional gaps that both people need, it's amazing how both people hunger for sex. Even the low sex drive partner, because they want it. They want to kind of crown the experience. They want to make everything else feel that much more special, because everything else is going so well. I want it to be that next level. And anyway, so if you're that partner that's looking like, oh, we just never have sex. It's never happening anymore. I don't know how to make that increase. I really want to, but, you know, my partner's just like ice princess, or they're just stone cold. They don't even care. They're totally detached. Don't look at your partner as the problem. What do you need to do to help your partner feel connected again? You connect. And interestingly, most times you get a positive response. It'll take time, but it comes. And to answer that person's question, no one should have to go into a marriage thinking that sex is an obligation. That isn't true. However, I think that there's at least cause for saying this one last thing, is that I would say many times it's the woman that does this, but it doesn't have to always be the woman. Sometimes it can be the man. Sometimes sex is used as a weapon, you know, or a bargaining chip, or how am I going to get things done the way I want it? Well, I guess I'll throw sex in as a bargaining tool. That is completely and totally unhealthy. That is not what it's for. That's a recipe for having your marriage end up feeling less and less attached. Even if the sex is great, even if you're able to connect great for the moment, you're setting yourself up for failure. Don't do it. Sex should be something that both of you are mutually interested in. It should be something that if you're not mutually interested in, work on it. And whether that means going to a counselor, which, by the way, actually helps quite a bit. I keep seeing it happen. It's not like a magical mystery thing. You can actually get tangible progress in your intimacy if you go to a counselor. But sometimes you can do it just by connecting with each other on your own terms at home. Make sure that your intimacy is fluent and active on all levels. And that's physical, emotional, spiritual, mental, even occupational. What closeness and bonding are you building?
Cool. Let's ask a couple questions and then get you out of here. What is your calling right now in your ward?
That's interesting. I am a ward missionary, and I am also teaching the 11-year-olds in primary.
Yeah. Mm. There you go.
There you go.
That's heavy.
Yeah. I started teaching the 12-year-olds with 2013.
It's good times.
How's that going?
Yeah, we'll talk about that some other time. If you could pick a calling for yourself, either invent one or a calling that already exists, what would you pick?
Oh, wow. This is going to sound funny, but I wish there were relationship coaches that were actually qualified within the church. I love bishops. Please don't misunderstand me. I love bishops, and I think it's a wonderful idea to go to your bishop if you want some advice, a third party to just kind of bounce ideas off of. go for it. It's a good thing. However, a lot of times when the relationships really get stuck or you kind of hit some potholes and pitfalls, you don't know what to do with it, it'd be nice to have someone that you could go to, an unbiased but educated opinion, to just kind of bounce some ideas off of and not feel like it's funny. I'd love for it to be just like a matter of course. Well, of course we do. The Catholic Church, for example, has, for a lot of their parishes, premarital counseling is just expected. You just go. Of course you do.
And to have someone that's of their faith, too, and understand their beliefs on top of that, I think.
Yeah, why don't we have that?
I don't know.
We need to pitch that.
I would love for it to happen.
We'll get on that.
Thank
you.
I appreciate that.
We'll get on. And then finally, what is your favorite part of your faith?
Of my faith? These are... You're throwing me curveballs here. I'd say, I guess it's a knowledge and understanding of why I'm still engaged in my life, why I'm still engaged. When things get hard, I know why I'm still going. I know where I'm headed in terms of the purpose. I know for myself, life's too hard to not have some sense of underlying direction. This keeps me on track. And sometimes life is hard. Sometimes I get just horrifically busy and I just get lost in everything. That's very real. I know that's true. But I love the idea that at the end of the day, overwhelmed or not, stressed or not, I know what matters. And I know where to invest more of my energy, more of my time, more of my love. Because I know long-term, big picture, where it's going to pay off.
Tell people where they could get in touch with you. We ask people to climb up on the Rammy Umptum and let people know where they can get in touch with you or call you or email you or websites, that kind of stuff.
Sure. You, more than welcome to call me. Go to our website, www.ambercreekcounseling.com. And we have a Facebook page there with daily tips for how to live a healthy life. If you like us there, you'll just be on kind of the, every day you'll get a new something to kind of spark your thinking and make your relationships better, help you feel happier and healthier. I'm on Pinterest. You can follow me on Pinterest.
Nice.
I get a lot of cool dating ideas there. A lot of times people are like, well, I want my marriage to be better, but I have no idea how to get it, you know, back on the living scale again. Well, there's some cool dating tips there. I post them all the time. And then we also have a blog, ambercreekcounseling.org. You can get all this through the website. Go to the website, ambercreekcounseling.com, and then you can see all this stuff. There's links for them. So we do individual, family, and couple counseling there. And something else that we do, which I'm actually a really big fan of, is we do couples classes. On the weekly basis, we'll do them. You know, people can come, they get some refreshments. You guys know about refreshments.
Oh, yeah. We're well aware.
And then you can, you know, kind of for an hour, I do a PowerPoint, and I like to keep it entertaining. We have like video clips and movies and stuff, and we'll kind of talk it through hands-on so people can talk about relationships without feeling like it's weird. Right. It's just, you know, casual, low-key.
Do you charge for those?
Or? We do charge. Those classes are $40. You come as a couple, and we talk for about an hour, hour and a half.
It's a date night, though, with refreshments.
Yeah, it's a good time.
Cheaper than dinner at a movie.
Individuals and leave as a couple.
There we go.
That should be your slogan.
That's right. And then done and done. And we also have, and this one we did trademark. We do have parenting classes called Decoding Your Teen. And we also have classes.
Oh, I'm there.
And then we have More from Marriage is our trademark dinner classes. People can come on a Friday night. We have like Cafe Rio comes and caters for us. Ooh. And, you know, we'll do like a 2 or 3 hour discussion. Again, laid back. You know, it's like, you know, 5-6 couples come at a time. You can ask questions, you know, joke around. And I show a PowerPoint and entertain people with movie clips and whatever. And we dig into how to make relationships their happiest. And we do those first Friday every month and sometimes more times on occasion. We also will come to your church group or your community group for free. We'll just come and just talk, do like little firesides if you want, or little discussions. Happy to do it. We want to have a presence in the community and be a resource. So give us a call, ambercreekcounseling.com. We'd be happy to help.
Make sure if you do that you mention that you heard about it on the Cultural Hall. We hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body.
And that when the time comes, you can travel home in safety.
And if you weren't healthy enough to listen to the podcast this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you.
On the back row.
Of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat.